floating to reporters the notion that as many as a third of the voters might vote against Eisner. Each day seemed to bring more bad news for the embattled Disney team. On February 25th, CalPERS announced that it would cast its votes with Roy and Gold and vote against Eisner, followed by state pension funds in Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New Jersey. Even New York, where Disney had done so much to help revitalize Times Square, and Florida, with its massive Disney presence, joined the fray, saying they would withhold support for Eisner. Mutual fund company T. Rowe Price, Disney's 14th largest shareholder with 19 million shares, called for Eisner's ouster. Alan Havesi, New York's comptroller and director of the state's retirement fund, which owned 8.7 million shares, issued a statement saying, "I call on Disney directors to separate the positions of chairman and chief executive and to replace Mr. Eisner as soon as possible." Disney dismissed the state pension fund actions as headline-grabbing by aspiring politicians motivated by personal political gain and not the interests of Disney shareholders. But there was no denying the silence from Eisner supporters. Not one state government said it would vote for Eisner. Disney had mounted a campaign to generate letters of support for Eisner from prominent entertainment executives and other businessmen. It had yielded little. Marty Sklar, the head of Disney's Imagineers, wrote an op-ed piece calling Eisner a great creative force and the ideal creative partner. Barry Diller, asked about Eisner on CNBC, said only that he was a longtime friend and supporter, and that he thought Eisner would keep his job. General Electric's Jack Welch, also on CNBC, praised Eisner as a creative genius, but otherwise the silence was deafening. Even Sid Bass, for so long Eisner's staunchest backer, remained silent. On March 2nd, it fell to George Mitchell to make Disney's case in the Wall Street Journal. He argued that there was no immediate need to divide the posts of chairman and chief executive and stressed Disney's governance reforms. "The changes we have made have resulted from our listening. We listened to the concerns that have been expressed about the company and about all of corporate America. We heard the concerns that boards were too large, that they were not independent enough, had too little diversity and not enough expertise, that there was not enough turnover, that they were too insular. We listened, and we took action. Michael Eisner listened, too. He initiated many and embraced all of these changes and encouraged their speedy implementation." 2 days before Disney's annual meeting in Philadelphia, Eisner spent the night in New York with Jane. The next day, they were being driven to Philadelphia when Eisner got a call reporting that Disney had just heard from Fidelity, which controlled over 3% of Disney's shares. Disney had been counting on Fidelity's support. Just days earlier, Eisner had been assured he had it. Now he learned that Fidelity was casting its votes against him, voting no with Gold and Roy. Eisner turned to Jane. "Everybody hates me," he said. 17. March 2nd, 2004 is a clear, mild day in Philadelphia. Though Save Disney's rival meeting isn't scheduled to begin until 4 p.m., by 1 p.m. a line has formed on the sidewalk at the Lowe's Hotel, a nondescript modern building located around the corner from the convention center. By 3:30, hundreds of people are waiting. Many in line